I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to Alternative Outlook. Other news sources read from a news feed in their skyscrapers. Alternative Outlook is on the ground, where people speak for themselves, producing an alternative narrative rarely heard in the mainstream media.
We also provide a platform for intellectuals who question the establishment while offering solutions ignored by those in power. Alternative Outlook is about building solidarity through illustrating the interconnectedness of struggles throughout the world and revealing a consistent, unifying struggle and theme, resisting the inherent exploitative nature and systematic shortcomings of capitalism.
I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. All right, welcome to this week's episode. Today we're going to have a report back from the Cannes Film Festival. This is a part two of a three-part series from media professor Dennis Bro at Long Island University. We also have a continuation of our narratives of houselessness in the United States, with a produced segment entitled American Homelessness that me and a friend of mine, Alex Stoller, put together. And that's going to consist of various conflicting opinions regarding the issues surrounding homelessness. We also have an interview with longtime Newark, New Jersey homeless man, Peyote, which was also conducted by Alex Stoller and I. And we have a segment coming from Boulder, Colorado, titled Weed Between the Lines, about cannabis issues, and we have much more. So first, I'm going to go into this American Homelessness segment produced by myself and street intellectual Alex Stoller. American Homelessness. What are the primary causes of homelessness? Professor of Social Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, Dennis Culhane.
People who are homeless have lower rates of education and literacy than people who are not homeless and who are also poor. So that is absolutely a fact. And there is a legacy of, you know, educational neglect in the post-war era, really post-World War II era, that particularly affected these Rust Belt cities and many cities around the country. And we saw this whole, you know, bifurcation in terms of educational quality and achievement by race that emerged as cities became concentrated with more poor people and more African Americans, and suburbs became more concentrated with, you know, middle and upper class white people. So we had a very bad post-war story about public education in this country, funded by local taxes as it is. And so there's little political support for shoring up these systems. They become racially isolated, these schools, if you will, sort of, you know, continuing segregation problem. So there's no question that an inadequate education is a fundamental factor that has limited the labor market mobility of poor people, and including the people who become homeless.
Lisa Wilson, program manager at Long Branch Concordance.
You don't have to necessarily have a college education. I think that if you avoid a few things, like dropping out of high school and getting pregnant young and getting married too young, I think that if you can at least graduate from high school, wait to plan a family, and get employment, gainful employment, at a living wage. The whole wage thing is the issue. $8 an hour in Monmouth County, if you made $8 an hour, you'd have to work four full-time jobs to live here, to make $45,000 a year, because to afford rent here on a one-bedroom apartment, you have to make between $44,000 and $64,000.
Professor of Social Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, Dennis Culhane.
I think that the historical legacy of racism and institutional racism is absolutely a major part of the homelessness problem. The fact that half of the homeless are African American, even though they're 12% of the U.S. population, is pretty clear evidence that there is a huge component of institutional and the legacy of racism that has impacted this population. And the thing is that's difficult about that is that those problems affect people across a life course. You know, it's not just something you can measure today. Oh, a person's African American, this person's white. How are their risk factors impacting whether they're homeless or not? Because what happens is these are, you know, people who have had life experiences across their whole lifespan, across generations in their families, and across their whole communities, which have led to the disadvantage that accumulates in a single person's life.
Karen Hudson, Program Manager, Homeless Health Initiative.
The numbers are disproportionate in any of these large systems that are really impacting African Americans. So certainly here in Philadelphia is a large city, and primarily the population is African American that you're going to see in homeless shelters. But our initiative is actually beginning to branch out a little bit to some suburban communities. When I have to tell you, you know, for people to again believe that all homelessness only happens in a city like Philadelphia, it doesn't only happen in a city like Philadelphia. It really happens in affluent communities like Bucks County, and they have one shelter, you know, over a large county because it shouldn't happen there. They just don't expect it to happen there. Or, you know, let's just really make it invisible when the truth of the matter is it really can happen anywhere and everywhere. But again, to fit with all the disproportionate numbers, that's what we see in Philadelphia. And we have actually had the chance to see through this initiative and our partnerships with a number of different shelters. At least one of our shelters we go to now, and there are families. I mean, it's a mother and a father and kids that are actually in a shelter. We're seeing more white families in one of our shelters than we've ever seen before. So clearly the economy is touching what the face of homelessness is beginning to look like in Philadelphia as well.
How did you become homeless? Tiffany.
I have a disorder I have a seizure disorder. Yes. And I had a seizure at my last job, and that's really how I got laid off, because I had a seizure at the job, and yes.
It's terrible.
Yes.
You can't get laid off for having a seizure at work.
I know. And I went to the hospital for it, and when I came back, what happened was my boss, she cut my hours, and my hours were, you know, then she cut my hours some more, and then cut hours more, and eventually it was, well, we don't need you anymore, so.
Robert Pacheco, homeless man.
I was working, and unfortunately I got sick, and people I was working for didn't appreciate me being out so long, even with the doctor's note, so they let me go. And in the process, I was taking care of my girlfriend's stepdaughter and her while she was going to school, and she ended up leaving me, taking my stepdaughter with her, and end up losing my apartment, my job, and basically everything I have. Basically one thing after another basically happened and just landed me in in a bad place, but in just a place that most people wouldn't really want to experience in their life.
Tina Dykes, homeless mother.
My mom at the time, she was on drugs, and she was telling me that she needed help, my help. So I came down here from Harrisburg, packed all my stuff, came down here. She told me that she had found me a house. I had saved all my money up. Came down here, it wasn't a fact. She was still doing drugs. We wound up staying at her house, and we was all sleeping on a twin pull-out bed. And she was still doing drugs, doing it in front of the kids. And then I was like, I have to go. I went to my uncle's house. I thought they would be up and up, not doing drugs, not none of that. Come to find out, they was doing the same thing. So I left there. I went to, what is it? Salvation Army. I asked them, what do I have to do to get into shelter? They told me I had to stay here, then I had to go to OSHA. The next morning I went, and then I went to a couple of other shelters before I actually came here. The other shelters, it wasn't for me. I couldn't really handle some of the stuff that was going on. It was filthy. It was rats running across their vents. It was just a whole bunch of other stuff going on that I knew I wasn't able to do. So after that, we left and went to another shelter. I went to Wayne Hall. It was a nonprofit shelter. I did the program there for, I think it was like 6 months. I was done with the program because I wasn't on drugs. I wasn't on no alcohol. So I didn't have any problems. It was just me out of housing. So I finished the program. I was still homeless.
Is government support enough? We're at the Newark, New Jersey ShopRite with Ciata Bond, a homeless mother. We begin walking around the supermarket and having a conversation.
I do receive food stamps. It's about $247 a month for the entire month. So I have to divide everything equally and make sure I bargain shop and sometimes use coupons even as well. So can't really get everything I want and everything like that. So I'm about to see how I spend my food stamps and how I make things stretch for me and my child, Zaria. For the month, so. Okay, 99 cents, you can't be stitch. It doesn't matter. This ShopRite brand, store brand, definitely good.
Mommy, gotta go to ShopRite.
Yeah. Generics is all that's affordable.
Okay, but you can't eat it right now. Things like this. This is like, you know, $3, like stuff like that. I can't get it. I can't. But you know how you always have a sweet tooth to get things like that? I can't. That's
not in the budget.
Not in the budget at all. Not in the budget. I don't get all those things.
Only the necessities?
Only necessities, basically. You try. Yeah. This will last me, this lasts us for about maybe a week. After another week, I probably have to refill up on bread, juice, milk especially. Yeah. And, that's about it. Yeah, lasts about a week.
Their food for the week hardly seems like enough for a mother and her growing child.
I have to split it up weekly, to just have more money to spare towards the end of the month because it'll usually run out pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I split it up by weekly and get, you know, make it stretch out for weeks. So I separate my weeks and 4 weeks out the month. So then that way I should be okay. For the month I received about $247. And trust me, for the two of us, from me and my child.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is that enough now?
No. No way near. By the time you start getting, you know, your meats and the vegetables are sky high now. And just for like cereal and milk, you're spending almost close to $7, $8, you know. So, yeah, everything is expensive now. And I just try to make it work. It's nowhere near enough. Nowhere near.
Tina Dykes, homeless mother of four.
I get cash assistance and food stamps and medical assistance. That's all for right now.
How much is it a month usually?
My cash is, I think it's like $589 a month. And the food stamps is like $702 a month.
And is it enough for the five of you?
It's never enough for five of us because it's the five of us. We can't really live off of $589, but I make do with it.
Is our government properly addressing the issue of homelessness? Russell Rooster Valentini, homeless advocate and liaison for Allentown, Pennsylvania schools.
I think the government has good intentions. My concern is there's not enough discussion with the ground level people. It never makes it down to the ground level people. We do some things to try to make things easier, but most times they're trying to make things easier for the workers instead of the homeless folks. I'm really believe sometimes that more money doesn't need to be allocated if it goes to the right places. I'll give you a real quick example. We have rental assistance programs. You have to be a full month behind on rent and get a letter from your landlord you're about to get evicted. Okay? So we're asking people to go up and stick their head in the noose. Okay? Most times, my experience has been, people are just shy, sometimes $60 on a rent or something. We have no mechanism to help them with this little small thing when they're behind a little bit. I've had people get evicted for the sake of $11 because the whole rent has to be paid. I would like to see that it isn't an all or nothing thing. Same thing with electric. You have to be $250 in arrears to get help with your electric. What if you're only $40 shy? Why not give them $40? They're current with their electric, no late fee, no budget needed, and they can do that. That's some of the stuff that I just wish we could do. I know we don't do it because it's a management problem, but many times it is just a small, small thing for some of these families to get a bus pass to get to someplace. When you're on food stamps, you can't get things to clean yourself up. We're telling you, you gotta go get a job and stuff, but you cannot get anything with food stamps to clean yourself up.
Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs.
I don't think that the issue of homelessness is being really addressed in any kind of realistic way by any governments in the United States, whether it's federal, state, or local governments, in that it's essentially like this criminalization of homeless people is like the largest amount of resources are put into that, trying to hide people. And then the basic fundamental crisis for most people who are becoming homeless or who could actually not be homeless if there was universal health care in the United States, if there was adequate employment, if there were mental health services. The basic fundamental structure of the United States at all levels is such a total failure that that's why we have one of the largest homeless populations on earth.
Lisa Wilson, program manager, Long Branch Concordance.
I think that inept federal policy has really tied the hands of our county and local municipalities. They're our partners, you know. However, the funding is limited and the rules are like on the verge of ridiculous. So, I mean, $10 of income can mean the difference of whether you keep or lose your food stamps, your TANF benefits, which all affect your housing. Once people lose any kind of local welfare and food, and then money that they would put towards utilities, then you are completely homeless. It's always been this way. Social services is kind of punitive. I mean, we fund people just enough to keep them in poverty.
What can be done to better address this important issue? Professor of Social Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, Dennis Culhane.
I think you have to think about it on a number of different levels. So there are a lot of issues that need to be addressed that are much broader than the homeless population, but which have a big impact on the homeless population. An example there would be the inadequacy of the Supplemental Security Income Program, disability insurance, for poor people. You know, people who have serious mental illness are probably the most visible part of the homeless population. They may not be by any means a majority of the population, but they're the most visible and clearly a very needy group of individuals. And right now, the only income that they can get is from SSI, and it's about $600 a month. And they cannot afford market rents on the basis of that income. So as a structural problem goes, that is a huge issue. Another issue is the unemployment insurance program. I mean, most unemployed people are not eligible for unemployment insurance.
Program manager at the Homeless Health Initiative, Karen Hudson.
Well, I think that part of it goes back to a root cause in terms of education, employment, and it starts at an early age. And until we can value those kinds of services, until we can arm people, families, individuals with the skills that they're going to need in order to be able to survive in the tough times in the economy that we have, I think that we're doing folks an injustice. So I think that all of that's really critical in terms of what it is that we need to be doing to help. You know, you could certainly give somebody a fish if they're hungry, but if you teach somebody how to fish, you know, you're really doing something that's going to help them in the long run over time. And I don't think that we do enough of that on a systemic level.
Melissa Berrios, social worker at the Homeless Health Initiative.
I think that aside from affordable housing, we need jobs that pay an actual living wage, not just something. Just because we're giving people money doesn't mean we're actually helping them to sustain a lifestyle. And also, I just think the fact that community has changed so much in our society, that's also a piece of it. So yes, the government has a role, but we have a role as citizens to take care of each other. And I think that there, you know, one thing, one theme that I think emerges from a lot of the parents we talk to is this lack of a support network, and how something that you or I could experience, like the loss of a job or moving from one state to another, if we have a support network, then it's not going to affect us in the same way as someone who doesn't have a support network. So they would end up living in a shelter because they don't have those people to catch them and to help them out in the same way that you or I may have that. So I think that we have a responsibility as individuals to take care of each other, kind of just help out and provide that safety net before someone, you know, falls all the way down, that we're kind of helping them along the way in addition to what the government can do to help out.
Darcy Dobbins, Executive Director, Long Branch Concordance.
There's a lot of people who believe that the government spends money on poor people, which is absolutely not true. This country has a lot of private nonprofits like us, agencies that are self-funding. It's a very complex process to apply for grant funding. It's consuming of time and resources. So it's, as I said, a patchwork. I do believe that the new administration, our new president, has a real understanding of this problem. He did bring himself up, as they say, from his bootstraps, but he understands what it's like for a single mother to try to get a quality education for her children, to have to work two and three jobs. I think that what the federal government can do is make it easier for people to get education, to get training. One of the things that's very important in this country is, I think if we had quality daycare, that would help a lot of people move on and attain some of this education, attain some training. So I do believe that our current administration understands the problem very well in light of all the other problems we have going on. I don't know. I think that most people know that our country needs to re-engineer, needs to educate, needs to bring all of our public into the current century.
on the World Film Beat with my second Cannes report, in which we'll be discussing perhaps the last films by Jean-Luc Godard and Ken Loach, and also those of the Dardennes and Mike Leigh. First, we must go back to distribution, because really that's the story of this year's festival. That in the same way that television is no longer watched by a national audience in the home on the set at the same time, so too films are being watched at all hours on the same multiple platforms and are and want to be readily accessible. If Cannes is anything, it's about the maintenance of what Walter Benjamin called aura, the impression the art object radiates of being original, of a single time and place. Thus, the walk up the red carpet and the moment of the film playing on its anointed night is supposed to be an event that can't be duplicated and is then supposed to create a tension that will transfer to the film's release days, months, and even years from now, as writers and critics recall its reception at the film festival. That whole idea is being rapidly eroded. The films, rather than having an aura today, don't even have Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame. In Paris and around the world, Cannes is being used more and more as an active platform to immediately open the film as soon as or even while it's being seen at the festival. In Paris, the Godard and Dardennes films open immediately after, and most of the English releases, including films by David Cronenberg and Tommy Lee Jones, were timed to use the festival as an immediate launching pad. This weekend in Paris, Le Monde presented 10 of the films in competition to join the 4 films that had already opened, which means someone not attending the festival by its closing day could have seen 14 of the 18 films in competition, which in a way makes the jury selection more democratic, since those not at the festival can now play along at home. Next week, as is customary, 3 other sections of competition will also play in Paris, and the film festival is having to undergo a major adjustment in terms of losing its air of exclusivity. And speaking of television, for the 3rd time in the last 5 years, a TV series has been one of the hits of Cannes. This started in 2010 with Olivier Assayas's Carlos, continued last year with Jane Campion's Top of the Lake, the success of which may have contributed to her being chosen jury president this year, and is in a way crowned with French bad boy director Bruno Dumont's Petit Cancan, a Twin Peaks-ish comedy policiere with Dumont's own twisted side effects. That was another hit of the festival. In French production, as around the world, the television series is becoming the mid-level, mid-budget film. In France, as in Hollywood, it's drawing the cinéma des auteurs into its orbit. Which brings us to the prizes. Grand prize won, prize to Nuri Bilge Ceylan, now a Cannes perennial, with one of his long nights of the soul, Journeys into Darkest Anatolia. Godard finally, for the first time, won a prize at Cannes, a shared 3rd prize with the up-and-coming Xavier Dolan. And Mike Leigh's actor and Mr. Turner won for Best Actor, while Juliette Moore and David Cronenberg's Map of the Stars beat out France's Marie Cotillard in the Dardennes' Deux Jours Une Nuit, or 2 Days, 1 Night. American critics felt that tale, the Cronenberg film, of an aging actress was far more sympathetic than Cotillard's quiet dismantlement as the working-class breadwinner of her family in a Europe in full economic crisis. And that difference perhaps describes the difference in the politics of the two continents. In Europe, there's still talk of ordinary people's sufferings. In the U.S., ordinary people don't suffer, only aging actresses who can't get the roles they used to in Hollywood any longer. Only they suffer, or rather, only their suffering counts. A word about the politics Hollywoodian of the festival selection and the prizes. The French critics noted that prizes exactly accommodated Hollywood. Bennett Miller for Foxcatcher as Best Director, Hollywood film. Julianne Moore, and they also noted many fine female performances, including also Kristen Stewart and Olivia Sayas' Sil Maria. And that young French directors were not honored. Liberation, French newspaper, found it strange that what they termed a masterpiece, the last anime by the Japanese co-founder with Miyazaki of Studio Ghibli, Miseo Takahata, the film called The Tale of Princess Kaguya, would be ignored by the Cannes jury, while a Variety critic, on the other hand, flipped over the less than inconsequential How to Train Your Dragon 2, calling it everything that cinema should be. There are a lot of prizes at Cannes besides the official awards, and the International Film Critics Prize also went to Ceylan's Winter Sleep, while the Catholic Ecumenical Award went to the Malian director Sizako's Timbuktu. The Cine Foundation, honoring the next generation of filmmakers, usually coming out of film schools, this time honored all the usual suspects, directors from film programs at Austin in Texas, at NYU, at the Centro Sperimentale in Italy, and at Great Britain's Film and TV School, won all four awards, which is sort of a major sweep for kind of the major schools, and which does not bode well for films from other regions. Okay, now, at last, and finally, it's time to talk about some films. First of all, we'll start with Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner. Timothy Spall, the actor playing the English painter William Turner, won the prize for acting and remained in character during his speech. He was a major force in Secrets and Lies, Mike Leigh's earlier film, but couldn't come to Cannes, he said, because he was dying of cancer. I'm now back and alive, he said, barking at the audience in character as Turner. The film itself is a portrait of the artist as a resolvedly working-class intellectual, delighting in eating pig's heads, copying a feel from the maid, grunting and growling with a heavy Cockney accent with his Dotty as his agent, forgetting or refusing to remember that he has a wife and kids, and sounding for all the world with his cackling like Burgess Meredith's Penguin on the old Batman, though you may remember Danny DeVito. The film contains a number of beautiful Turner-like landscapes, like the opening shot in Holland with two women in Dutch hats, speaking Dutch, walking through the orangish-red hue at dusk that in a way defines Turner. And there are more shots like this in the way that reminds one of Kubrick's use of 18th-century painting to capture the look and feel of the world of Barry Lyndon. We discover again that Mike Leigh is one of the greatest directors with actors, with his actors working weeks ahead and Leigh providing an atmosphere in which they can flourish. The problem is the film is too withdrawn into Turner's world with no real echoes of anything else. The other problem is it keeps repeating the same performance of Turner in the same register and is prone to becoming a very beautiful series of grunts and growls. And now to Jimmy's Hall, directed by Ken Loach with a screenplay by Paul Laverty. There's a suggestion the film will be Loach's last. If so, the French paper Libération or Libé called it a failed adieu. The film is set in the Ireland of the 30s, where after the Irish Rebellion, Ireland becomes a democracy, albeit one with its class injustices repressed. And they resurface with the reappearance in this small rural enclave of a former activist, Jimmy Gralton. Jimmy revives an old dance hall, and with it the possibility of hope for the rural poor in their struggle against the landlords, which the Catholic Church and the new Irish state in collusion had buried, or had gotten rid of that struggle. In the end, Jimmy's led away to be deported as the local young people and even the priest who had scorned him cheer his departure. The film does sometimes feel like a repetition, and it is, but it's a good kind of repetition. Yes, we've seen it before in other Loach films. The ending is almost exactly that of Bread and Roses, but we're not seeing it anywhere else. I like the film, and I do like Laverty's work with Loach. He has been roundly decried for ruining Loach in a fallow period, but I think some of those films will be revived, including three that really are ahead of their time. Bread and Roses, about the new female global workforce. It's a Free World, which is the best film made about working people being enrolled under and sucked into neoliberalism, and Root Irish, about the perpetual working class enlistment and fighting continual wars. This film, as I said, is about 30s Ireland, and there's a very strong moment when Jimmy steps into the decrepit hall that was a symbol of its past dreams, and it's very touching, recounting a left that's just a memory, and Jimmy's hair is graying, and the woman he left behind is no longer young either. There is in this moment, in this relationship, not the excitement of youth, but a tender feeling for a youth lost. The film then moves a bit too quickly into a flashback of what happened in the previous period, and then we're back to the present. There's then the struggle to reopen the hall against the tyrannical priest backing the church and its alliance with landowners to keep its supreme authority in Ireland. In his most rousing moment, Jimmy gives a speech about how in the 20s, the U.S., where he was exiled, was a land of bounty, but the U.S. has this bounty no more in a way that describes the present-day U.S. He also talks about how the deal made for a quasi-independence by an Irish state was a victory, especially for big landlords in the class war. There's a bit of a paint-by-numbers quality to it, with Jimmy's exile in the end seemingly following a Loach pattern, but what is interesting is that Loach and Laverty bring a historical drama up to the minute, with Jimmy's speech about how the land of plenty America turned rotten after a severe depression that resembles our recession, and how democracy, in quotes, as it is used in all the more in the even more depressed economy of Ireland, can easily be simply a cover under which the class war is carried out even more stringently, a lesson we're learning every day. Next is Adieu à Langage, Godard's film. The critics noted that 58 years separate these two jury prize winners, Godard and Xavier Dolan, for Mommy. And yet, in some ways, it's difficult to say who is the octogenarian. Godard is always experimenting, and this film and his form of distribution at Cannes is no exception. Godard did not come to the festival, but he made an 8-minute film to explain why it was not there. That was the talk of the festival. The film is in 3D, and it attempts to bring many of his consistent formal concerns into the newly popular medium, so that it becomes more than just Imperial Hollywood forcing other movie industries to catch up to an expensive technology, including having some of the footage shot from cell phones and then transferred into the 3D process. Godard transposes different meanings of the words, including the main pun of his title, in different 3D axes. So his ah in the foreground with Dieu, or God, in the background, with the pun then meaning both oh God and goodbye. Like other Godard films, it's replete with references not only to the history of cinema. There's a sequence in which the main couple fight in bed over a quilt that recalls Hitchcock's couple fighting over who will get the bedspread in the 39 steps, but also to Godard's past films. The film starts its titles over mid-film in a rerun of Un film comme les autres, a film like the others, and over ominous music, a tourist boat keeps circling the screen, reminiscent of the leisure liner in his last work, Film Socialisme. The social critique is as strong as ever. In Adieu, in describing the current mediascape, a character speaks of the non-thought contaminating thought. But there's also here a pondering of the eternal, the oh God, and in the end, the adieu, and a mood that is not nostalgic, but is more reflective over shots of his dog in the woods than the more frenzied forward thrust of Film Socialism. Under the last image are the words, don't know when we'll be back, suggesting this may be the end. And if it is, this is not a failed adieu, but a director whose work is once again challenging all areas of film production, promotion, and distribution. Last this week, but not least, is my particular Palme d'Or winner, the Dardenne's Du Jour Ennui, or 2 Days, One Night, the best film about the crisis, or rather the companion to the other best film, Inside Job. Where that film used a documentary to describe the elites pummeling the economy from the inside, the Dardennes give us a documentary of the soul, an up-close and personal look at the effects of the crisis on one woman, threatened with being fired, who must spend the weekend pulling her co-workers to ask them to vote against a bonus in order for her to keep her job. The woman is the family's breadwinner, with her factory job posed to her supportive husband's service sector employment in the equivalent of Happy Burger. The role is dramatically underplayed by the new star of French cinema, the next Isabelle Huppert, Marion Cotillard, who has previously been, sometimes like Huppert, known for her heights of paroxysm, particularly as a paraplegic in last year's Rust and Bones. But here, in a film that returns the Dardennes to the glory days of Rosetta and La Promesse, she is all restrained fear, a depressive trying to cope, as we watch the effects of this devastating economy and the neoliberal humiliation of one worker pitted against the rest, as she has to beg her fellows to support her. The film is an exploration of her personal reaction to this situation, but it's also, in a way that seems to make it a bicycle thief for the age of financialization, a survey of the contemporary working class as she journeys from one co-worker to another. The contradictions are often surprising. A male co-worker who she finds as a player in the macho enclave of a soccer game breaks into tears and pledges his support at her dilemma, while the husband of a female worker clad in the team soccer shirt of a fan drags his wife back into the house and will not have her wrecking his sports weekend to talk about giving back her bonus. This is a film about solidarity within a splintered working class, fractured within itself, and with each worker pitted against the others. It strikes the right note at the end with Cotillard alone, in a memory of Ricci and Bruno fading back into the crowd after failing to find their bicycle. A reminder to us that this class is even more broken down and alone and under attack now, with a recession following the years of neoliberal individualization and self-aggrandizement than in the devastation of post-war Europe. This is a marvelous, slowly building but exciting and devastating film, alarming in its simplicity, in which the Dardennes prove that their intensely personal tracking individual characters may in fact be the best way to convey the collective ruin that the bankers and investment houses continue to inflict on Europe and the world. Well, I'll be back soon with a look at the films outside the main competition, films that will be released through the year in the wake of Cannes. So this is Bro on the World Film Beat, signing off.
Welcome back to Alternative Outlook Radio. I'm your host, James Simmons. That was Dennis Breaux with his report back from Cannes. And now we will be moving on to an interview conducted by street intellectual Alex Stoller and myself, with Newark homeless man, longtime Newark homeless man and veteran, Peyote.
Peyote, what led to your unfortunate circumstances?
What do you mean, my unfortunate circumstance? I don't understand.
What are you talking about? Here?
I'm here because I had nowhere to go, and I came here. My last resort to come to this shelter. I've been in shelters in Newark. Oh, I've been there for 25, 30 years. I had to come to a shelter. The other shelter I was in, they closed down. And these other shelters, they don't want me in because of my alcohol addiction, right?
What was your childhood like?
What was my childhood like? Nothing. I never called no mommy, no daddy. Nothing like that. They died when I was like 9 years old. I don't want to talk about it, all right?
You don't have to talk about it.
There was nothing. I never called mom or dad. They passed away and they put me in orphanages and living with other people and shit, okay? That's it.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Nah, it ain't nothing sorry. I'm glad, because they never said nothing to me, fuckers.
Does the government help you at all? Do they provide any kind of support?
They give me welfare and stuff. I'm trying to get on SSI. I'm waiting for the next month. I tried like 3 times to get on SSD, you know, I'm waiting for the results. I don't know, it might come through, man, because I tried 3 times for it, and this is the longest I waited. So maybe I get a break, I don't know, you know, because I don't know what to do. I can't work. I'm not eligible. I can't hold a job or nothing. I can't work or nothing. I haven't worked in 30 years. I've been in shelters most of my life. You know, I've been in shelters around Newark. And on the streets, living in abandoned buildings and houses. That's all I did most of my life. Since I was about 24. I quit, man. I just quit. I went to the VA and shit. I went there so many times for alcohol abuse. I went twice to Alliance, you know, for the program. I came out, I did the same thing, drink. See, I'm in a program now. I'm in this program, these stars. I have to go unless they're gonna cut me off my benefits. Now, I haven't been there. I broke my shoulder. I had an operation on it just recently, you know, and it's still hurting. Now, I don't want them to cut me off my welfare, you know, because I won't be able to stay, you know, stay here. I'm on some program now. I'm on a, veterans thing now. I got it. It can't, I forget the name of it, but they're paying my rent, but I gotta pay like $22 a month of my own money. Now, I haven't been to my school because of this. I've been in the hospital. I got my papers and stuff, you know? I've been in the hospital and I've been just, because my arm is too painful to go walk. I gotta walk. I didn't get my bus card and I'm supposed to get a bus card. I messed everything up. Because of my drinking shit, you know?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
I've been doing this all my life, bro. Even in the service, I drank. What do you want to say?
Do you think that the government provides enough assistance for veterans?
Well, if you got something wrong with you, you could go to the East Orange VA hospital, or yeah, you could go right in there. And if you don't feel good, they'll take you right in. You know, without you show them your card and stuff, they'll take you. They don't have no. I didn't have no problem, you know. I was real sick one time and they took me right in, you know. I showed my card and because I was real sick.
Where did you serve in the service? Were you in the Army or Marines?
I was in the Navy.
Navy?
I was in overseas on a dry dock in Scotland.
From what years did you serve?
I served from 75 to 76.
So you were in Vietnam?
No, I was in a dry dock, on a submarine dry dock. You had to work on submarines. You had to sandblast them, water blast them, paint them. You had to do all kinds of shit. It was hard work. It was hard work. It was no joke. You come out that day, you're smelly, you're dirty, shit going in them holes, inside the bilges. You ever been in the submarine, inside of it, in the bilges, where they had to sandblast them, and they put lights on you, and you don't have no mask, the masks were all, the plastics were all, and you had a sandblast, the light don't even work, you just had a sandblast and paint them in the dark. I'd done that for almost two years, until they gave me, I got mad, I went off with them motherfuckers in there. That captain and everything on that ship, man. Shit, I told him, fuck you, motherfucker. I told him, fuck you. Put me to cat mask for something I didn't do. I'm busting my hump. I used to do half a submarine in one day. They couldn't believe. And paint it. I was strong, man. This is when I was 20, in my early 20s, 18, 19. Now I'm 53. You know, my body went down, man, from drinking. I used to drink. They gave me a discharge. They gave me general honorable conditions. As long as you leave here and go back and get your discharge papers, and I don't want to see you here again. I said, okay. The captain told me that. As much as I did for him, I busted my hump when I was young. I busted asses when I was young. I work hard, man. I was no chump. Now I ain't got nothing. I'm worn out.
All right. Is there anything you would like to add that you felt I have missed?
About what?
Just about anything in general. Homelessness in America, veterans, anything? Your experience?
All these politicians anyway, these president politicians, they're all so corrupt. They are so corrupt, it's ridiculous. Corrupt ass motherfuckers and get away with it. It's a damn shame.
It is a shame.
It is. That's all it is. Corrupt people in this world, in this government. There's corrupt governors, mayors, politicians, they're all corrupt. Man, these corrupt government, this corruption in this government, in this society of life, it's ridiculous. I hear it. It's disgusting. These mayors, all these towns, all these governors, all these politicians. You know those corporates? I'm glad they got busted. Them, what's his name? That big one, he got busted. All that big, what are you gonna do with $1 billion? They stole, them corporates stole billions and billions of dollars. They keep saying, and they finally got caught. And now they're in jail. And they're living like kings in there. Right?
Yeah. And it's unfortunate. You think a regular,
you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. You think if you got caught doing that, they'd give you a little slap on the wrist?
I swear. Put him in a cell for 20 years. Don't get out. Just feed him some shit food. All that money they stole. It's a real problem. I don't like this. They're stealing like crazy. I hate. Like it ain't nothing. They're enjoying right now. They're out there enjoying. And they're going out to these big flushy restaurants and eating real good and shit. Spending all that money. And here's a $20, $50 tip and shit. But I'm going to tell you something, man. Hey, I don't know what to do with my life. I never did.
Egypt continues its crackdown on free expression and adversarial journalism. More than 24 people faced trial this weekend for demonstrating without authorization. The defendants were arrested late last week while protesting a new law which curbs public displays of dissent. This comes amid an international outcry against prison sentences handed down Monday against three journalists from the Al Jazeera network. The three were sentenced to between 7 and 10 years in prison on charges they conspired with the Muslim Brotherhood to produce false news reports of political unrest in the country. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Egypt currently holds 14 journalists in its jails. Despite the controversy, the United States government has decided to renew military aid to Egypt, U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf.
Look, Egypt remains an important strategic partner. We share a number of transnational threats, whether you look at terrorism, whether you look at weapons proliferation. It's a key player in the region, quite frankly, for a whole host of reasons. Again, whether it's fighting the counterterrorism threat in Sinai, whether it's maintaining the peace treaty with Israel, we have a number of shared interests. So we believe it's important to maintain a relationship with Egypt.
Egypt has historically been a top recipient of U.S. military aid, second only to Israel. For more on the developments in Egypt, FSRN's Nell Abrams spoke with Sharif Gaber, a member of the Mosirin Independent Media Collective in Cairo, and an urban planner focusing on housing rights and social justice issues.
First, the verdicts. The convictions of the journalists came as a shock to many outside of Egypt. Was it a surprise within the country?
The severity of the verdict may have surprised some. However, when it really comes down to it, there were a lot of people who had serious doubts about the Egyptian judiciary for the last several years. I mean, I personally can remember a protest from July of 2011 that was calling for the purging or cleansing of the judiciary from corrupt Mubarak-era members. And I think we've seen a lot of signs in the past months that the judiciary, despite their claims of independence and despite the Ministry of Foreign Affairs' kind of insistence that no one comment on the Egyptian judiciary, is simply a kind of another arm, just like the police or the prosecution. I mean, this is part and parcel of the exact same police state and the exact same regime.
The media's focus on the trial was on the three Al Jazeera journalists, but there were others convicted as well. What's the rest of the story?
You know, others that were sentenced were many of them students or several of them students. They were working as assistants or working as producers. And even beyond this particular case, we just saw the release of Abdallah Shami, who was an Al Jazeera Arabic journalist, partially because he was on the verge of death because of a hunger strike, who had been held without even being charged for almost a year. There are still many, many, many other journalists and thousands of other political detainees in Egyptian prisons or Egyptian jails, some of them charged, some of them still awaiting charges even after up to a year even.
Sharif Gaber, you're a member of the Mosirin Independent Media Collective. Tell us about the group and where you see the future of independent media in the country.
I mean, the group founded in 2011 as a means to attempt to represent or to amplify the voices of those people in the streets when we realized that both the state media and the private media would not speak on behalf of or speak in favor of the revolution. We have had our successes, but recently within the crackdown, we've found it incredibly difficult to work. We've been very worried. And this is from a group that has had members who've definitely been injured and been arrested for doing this work. But, you know, we're certainly trying to figure out which direction to go right now in order to keep ourselves safe and at the same time find new ways to deal with what is an enormous crackdown.
A day before, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Egypt's President al-Sisi. Death sentences were confirmed for nearly 200 people, and dozens of others were arrested at a protest demanding the right to public assembly. What do these events say about a change, if any, in the government's commitment to expanding human rights in Egypt?
I was at the protest that was attacked, and it was just a bold-faced assault on an incredibly peaceful and rather small protest with the goal of, I think, just arresting as many people as possible. This protest law is not a regulation. This is a law criminalizing protest and criminalizing dissent. We've seen sentences of up to 15 years prison for simply participating in a protest. So I mean, I think that we, you know, the reaction in some ways, the media has been spouting that, you know, the protests are the cause of the problem. But really, I think that what the cause of the problem is that we're seeing a reformation and a crackdown by figures of the old regime, by the military, that is threatening any of the kind of real gains in political space that we've made in the past 3 years.
That was Sharif Gaber from the Mosserine Independent Media Collective. He spoke with FSRN's Nell Abram from Cairo.
Leland Rucker is a KGNU DJ. He also writes the Weed Between the Lines column for the Boulder Weekly, and we check in with him on Thursdays about this week's column.
Recently, New York became the 23rd state to approve medical marijuana. It's a great thing, you know, I'm very excited about that, except for one little caveat that they have. They're only allowing people who have serious medical problems. This is not, you know, they're not going to let 20-year-olds come in and say, I have a bad back. None of that stuff at all. This is for serious medical stuff. And after all this debate and a lot of compromises, you will be allowed to get marijuana in tincture form, in edible form, or vaporized, but you can't smoke it.
So what is the reasoning behind that?
Governor Cuomo has decided that he feels like that there could be a problem with marijuana being a gateway drug. Now, never mind that these are people with serious medical problems. You know, in a lot of cases, they might want marijuana so they can get off of prescription drugs, which actually are addictive. And the governor is worried that these people might become addicted to marijuana? This is just ridiculous. I can't even believe this. Since the whole idea of marijuana is a gateway drug to lead you to other drugs, and since that's been studied and studied, countless studies have been made, there seems to be absolutely no correlation at all. And yet, we still have people, prohibitionists mostly, who continue to give us this thing, oh, marijuana, we got to worry about it being a gateway drug. These are people that are sick. What are they going to do? Are they going to come in and find out that a person is smoking and arrest them because they're not in doing it the correct way? You know, here in Colorado, we found out that edibles can be a real problem. You know, edibles, especially for people who are using them for pain or for nausea or for appetite, you're not going to want to wait an hour and a half to see if it works. That's why smoking marijuana is generally for people who use it medically. An awful lot of people find that that's the best way because you get instant relief.
Well, in addition to New York, this week in your column, Weed Between the Lines, you're taking a look at Nebraska, and there's been a real clampdown on what's happening regarding marijuana in Nebraska. Tell us what you're going to be writing about. Well,
I don't know. I'm sure that anybody who lives in the Denver, the Boulder area, anywhere around here, who has ever traveled east and north has traveled up I-76. And it used to be, and this was a well-known thing, I got caught in it once, that in Sterling, you would get, they had a speed trap. And so you always slowed down in Sterling. Well, that's been changed now. Now, there's a marijuana store that has opened in Sedgwick, which is right there near the border where I-76 goes in. And a store is open there, and Nebraska police have gone completely crazy, Maeve. They're having to spend all of their money stopping everybody from Colorado to see if they have marijuana in their car. Again, you just think, why are you trying to stop everybody from Colorado? It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, I've heard anecdotally of people driving from Colorado into neighboring states being stopped because of the sheer fact of having a Colorado license plate. So it seems that it's not just Nebraska. I've heard similar stories from Utah, from Kansas, and from other states close to us here, that people with Colorado plates are being stopped because of this issue around the possibility of having marijuana.
I haven't been able to get an absolute on that, but there are a lot of anecdotal stories, and this just strengthens that. I mean, Nebraska police are scared. You know, I guess they're scared that maybe people will come into Colorado and they'll buy their quarter ounce if they're from out of state. If they're from Nebraska, they can buy their quarter ounce and then try to take it back into the state and resell it. I don't think that's really big business or anything like that. And again, why spend so much time and so much effort just to keep people from smoking marijuana?
Leland Drucker writes, "Weed Between the Lines."
That concludes this episode of Alternative Outlook. I hope you enjoyed the program. And don't forget to visit us at alternativeoutlook.org. And remember that the revolution begins in the mind of a child.